from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's edition of Forum in our opening hour, the attacks on the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo had deep personal resonance for Berkeley-based political cartoonist Khalil Bendib. One of his heroes, the cartoonist Jean Cabot, was among those killed, and as a Muslim, he says he fears a backlash. Bendib and Amir Soltani, co-authors of the graphic novel Zara's Paradise, join us to talk about balancing freedom of religion and expression in a multicultural society. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In the aftermath of the killings in Paris at the satiric magazine Charlie Hebdo and a kosher supermarket, we're joined in this morning's opening Forum hour by two Muslim artists, co-creators of the graphic novel Zara's Paradise, which is set in Iran. Iranian-born writer, journalist, and human rights activist Amir Soltani joins us along with Algerian-born cartoonist Khalil Bendib, who co-hosts a weekly radio program on KPFA in Berkeley, Voices of the Middle East. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you both here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let me begin, if I may, Amir Soltani, with you. And let me begin by just talking about how this hit you personally. I mean, I've heard you speak about it, and I'd like our listeners to know, as I said originally in the billboard this morning, you were very influenced, as I understand it, by Jean Cabot, who was a mentor and who was someone who inspired you.
Yes. I'm Khalil Bendib. I'm the one who has those ties with Paris. My first reaction was one of the sad deja vu, you know, because I was born into this sort of mayhem many years ago during the world.
In Algeria.
Yeah. And so my immediate reaction usually is, oh, no, this is still going on. When will it ever end? My family was nearly wiped out and similar senseless and terrible, brutal chaos in Algeria during the war. We just barely escaped, and I was born in Paris for that reason. So to me, it always feels like, my God, 50-plus years later, it's still going on. It's just really terrible. I also felt a tremendous sense of loss because these people were important to me. I've never met them personally, but two of them were close friends of one of my best friends in Algeria, who's also a cartoonist. His name is Slim. He's the dean of Algerian cartoonists, and he was really helped by them during the civil war in Algeria when he came under threat.
Specifically by Georges Walensky, I believe, yes?
Exactly. Yeah. Georges Walensky, who first got him a temporary job at Charlie Hebdo for 5-6 weeks, and then got him a permanent job at L'Humanité, the communist newspaper in Paris. So I felt very close to these two, to Cabus, who was an inspiration for me as a kid, because I grew up reading his comic strip, which was wonderful, The Grand Dudouche, about this teenager and his travails in school. It was rebellious against authority, just like his creator, Cabus. And Walensky, because of what he did for my friend, Slim. And I was quite incredulous at first that these two, of all people, would be among the victims. They had been shot. So a very, very terrible sense of loss.
Hit home with you, obviously.
Yes.
In a major way. And yeah. Also, not only because you came from Algeria and were once again exposed to this kind of violence, but also the fears that welled up in you that this would be attached to the Muslim community.
Exactly.
Islamophobia would again rear its ugly head and xenophobia. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's a spiral. The more of this type of violence happens, the more it justifies Islamophobia, or seemingly justifies it. They cannot justify it because this doesn't represent the community at large. This is an infinitesimal number of people among a larger society. Out of 6 million Muslims in France, 10% of the population, there are 1,000 who are considered dangerous and have been watched by the French police. So the apprehension of the backlash, which is inevitable, mosques have been attacked the past week, people throwing pig heads inside the mosques and people throwing grenades, bombs. It's been quite awful. And the sense that this spiral, this escalation, just feeds on itself. The Islamophobes feeding on the crazies who do this sort of thing, shoot people randomly, not randomly, but shoot innocent people. And the crazy fringe, the extremists, who feel justified when they hear and are witness to the prejudice, the media singling out one faith, one religious group. So it seems to be escalating.
Talking about somebody like Rupert Murdoch, for example, saying all Muslims are responsible.
Exactly. So it's very unfortunate, and you feel powerless when you see this happening time and time again. And you wish something could be done to stop it. On the other hand, I also see the positive things that are not so prominently displayed in the media. I go back two, three times to France, where my family still lives, and I see things that don't make it in the headlines. For example, people, the intermarriage between people, the increasing, and it seems that half of French society has a cousin, a brother, a sister who was married to an Algerian, to a Turk. So things are evolving positively in many ways that are not reported in the news. So it's not all a bleak story. It seems to be advancing on two fronts, one negative and one positive at the same time.
Well, the number of people who went out in March certainly is a great deal of positive light on this terrible tragedy. We're talking with Khalil Bendib, who's here with us in studio, co-creator of the graphic novel Zahra's Paradise and co-host of a radio program called Voices of the Middle East. How did you feel, though, about the cartoons themselves? I mean, I suppose somewhat ambivalent as a Muslim, no?
Absolutely. Ambivalent is a good way to describe it, because on the one hand, I'm completely dependent on freedom of expression as something that allows me to function. I voted with my feet many, many years ago. When I was 20 years old, I came to this country because I felt I would have the opportunity to express myself. So I do really treasure that freedom. It's allowed me to function, become successful, become a professional cartoonist, and reach a lot of people with my opinions. On the other hand, I have learned throughout my career, thanks to editors who were there to teach me, that you have to balance that freedom with responsibility, that there's no such thing as pure, complete freedom. It's a utopian notion. Your freedom to the freedom to swing my fist stops at your nose. It should, at least. So there's no such thing as freedom completely isolated from every other consideration. And this country is better at that kind of balance than France has been, obviously, because here you do worry about not insulting this or that other minority. It's part of our DNA here to always balance freedom and responsibility. France has done a little less has been a little bit less successful at that, obviously, because you have great cartoonists like Cabu and Walensky and the whole bunch who don't seem to, even though they're perfectly nice people, I know for sure, you know, as on a personal basis, they're lovely people, and I do miss them already. They're not sensitized to this sort of thing, that this is not happening in a vacuum, that when you insult what's most sacred to an entire community, it's going to have consequences, even if there's no violence. It has consequences.
Well, you yourself have had consequences from your cartoons.
Yes.
You've been threatened, I know. And
yes.
Let me get a reaction to you, because when you talk about the irresponsibility of the cartoonists, possible irresponsibility, not taking into account, Anti-Defamation League says about your cartoons, I'll just read a statement, Bendib's cartoons have employed a wide range of classic anti-Semitic images, commentary, and ugly stereotypes. Bendib has portrayed Jews as demonic-looking, crooked-nosed, bloodthirsty killers, and Israelis as monolithic, malicious schemers plotting to control the planet. End of quote, ADL.
Well, they're entitled to their opinion, obviously. But I and many of my friends who are not Muslims prefer to call them the Defamation League than the Anti-Defamation League, which I really think comes closer to the truth. They're not an honest group, you know, truly interested in fairness and correct depictions. They've just singled me out because I happen to be the one cartoonist, first of all, from an Arab country, and second of all, who dares to question conventional wisdom in this country when it comes to Israel and Palestine.
So this statement is a defamation.
It is a defamation. I never attacked them in a court of law because they have more lawyers than I would. I cannot really. But I have friends who have attacked them and won. I don't know if you're aware or remember what happened with Steve Seltzer and Jeff Blankfurt. They sued the ADL and they won. They got $25,000. It's a symbolic amount. But they were spied on by the ADL.
I remember it very well as a broadcast journalist and all. I guess the argument, though, is it responsible to portray in what might be taken as images that are hurtful or that can stir up volatile kinds of violence like we see in the case of France?
Yeah, I'm sure I'd be happy to debate the ADL about the quality of my cartoons because I feel they're very responsible. And they've been published by very responsible people. I do not myself just self-publish.
Our listeners can see them online.
Yes.
Which is interesting because we would be reluctant, as many have been, to put the cartoons of Charlie Hebdo online, which speaks volumes in many ways.
Yes. But in my case, my cartoons, I do argue they're not irresponsible. They're not anti-Semitic. They do challenge a lot of Israel's policies. When Israel bombs Gaza to smithereens, people cannot even flee. The borders are closed. These people end up being butchered 1,000 at a time. I do challenge that, and ADL just does not like me for that reason.
Khalil Bendib here with us in studio again as a political cartoonist and also co-hosts a weekly radio program on KPFA in Berkeley called Voices of the Middle East. Amir Soltani is a human rights activist and author, co-creator of Zahra's Paradise with Khalil Bendib. And again, that's a graphic novel that's set in Iran. Your background is Iranian. How much of this, I know you frame this in terms of blasphemy and the sacred as opposed to freedom of expression. I want to get into that with you. But how much of this has to do in some ways with maybe the Shia-Sunni split? Because out of Iran, for example, and a lot of this started with the fatwa against Salman Rushdie, but there have been statements not supporting what happened. In fact, quite the contrary. And Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, which is essentially Iranian-linked, has condemned what happened in Paris. One has to ask about the Sunni-Shia split in this, because so many of these groups, Al-Qaeda from Yemen, if they're responsible, Sunni. ISIS, Sunni. The breakdown.
I think it's, the sadness for me is that so many religious communities are actually being defined by violence, whether it's the Shia or the Sunni, the Jews, you know, whoever. The truth of it is, I mean, growing up in Iran, my experience of the Prophet, if you will, wasn't along the Sunni-Shia line. It was really through my grandmother. For her, Islam meant generosity, feeding the poor, charity, these kinds of very, it meant, you know, when we'd go on a trip, she would come out and pray. So for me, religion, in terms of the family that we were growing up, meant protection, a protection against death, protection against harm. And so to reach a point where that world is being turned inside out by so many political groups who use religion, especially the Prophet's name, to legitimize what is unacceptable, and I include Khomeini in that, is really a kind of cultural decimation that I find atrocious, as atrocious as I find Vice President Cheney's embrace of torture saving lives. This is, because this is America, this Constitution, the habeas corpus, this vast Anglo-American tradition being undermined here, and Islam, the Islam that I grew up with, which was all about love. My grandmother's Islam, granted, which was about love and protection, being turned into something that we don't recognize, shocks me.
Politics, nationalism, those kinds of things.
Absolutely.
Against what the religion and your grandmother's name taught you.
Yes. My grandmother, it's a strange thing, but, between my grandmother's Islam and Khomeini's Islam, there was a world of difference. And if you want to talk about blasphemy, what greater blasphemy than Khomeini claiming to represent the 12th Imam or to stand in his place or the current supreme leader of Iran? So
it's or Baghdadi claiming that he is the heir to Muhammad, perhaps.
Right. Or this Caliph al-Baghdadi, you know, it's like a, you know, and it's very interesting because people like Khalil and I find ourselves in a very delicate situation. When we did Zahra's Paradise, everybody was accusing us of being, you know, American, you know, the sort of Islamist extreme would come at us as, oh, you are Zionist stooges, you are, you know. Why? Because we dare to question an orthodoxy in Iran, which is this whole notion that is the Islamic Republic of Iran truly Islamic? When you look at the at many of the clergy that you don't hear about, they went up against Khomeini. And they recognized that Khomeini and others, and this goes all the way back to the death of the Prophet, have repeatedly used his name to legitimize claims to various things. And so it's funny because when we were coming over here, I was thinking, you know, again, back to the Islam of my grandmother, if you will, the Prophet's name was something that meant protection. It's something that it meant charity, generosity, these kinds of things. And it connected us to Jews, to Christians. You know, it was a connector. As Khalil was saying, it was an asset. It was something you could trust. Now, when you see people just assuming that they can essentially act as judge, jury, and executioner, whether it's with Charlie Hebdo or cartoonists in Iran or Algeria, it's a real crisis. It's a real crisis.
So, what was your response to the cartoons? I mean,
I don't like the Charlie Hebdo cartoons at all. But if they want to draw it, go for it. I mean, but here's the thing: there is a context in which these cartoons are appearing. So, you know, when Charlie Hebdo draws a picture of the Prophet's butt, and they say, do I not have the right to draw this? I mean, really? Do we need to go there? But then, you know, if you look at it in isolation, it doesn't mean very much. But then put it in the context of enhanced interrogations and rectal hydration and all of this thing. Then you enter a realm of humiliation. And that may be freedom of expression for some, but it's not something that I, as a Muslim, have to appreciate or accept, or frankly, not even as a Muslim, as someone who's watching things.
Is the new issue better that just sold millions of copies with the Prophet weeping, but not necessarily looking?
I think the question
quite
is,
handsome. In fact, quite the contrary.
Yeah. Right. I think the question is, and Khalil can speak to this much better than I, but I think the question is who gets to represent whom, and how. So I don't find these cartoons. You know, if it's a question for me, it's a question of respect. And it's, let's take, for example, another case, since you mentioned Murdoch. When Princess Diana was killed, when she died in the tunnel, you had all these photographers taking her picture while she was alive. And those photographs were purchased by Mr. Murdoch's for 300,000 or several hundred thousand pounds. They're just then smeared onto his newspapers to sell advertising. This is human blood. I mean, it's a human life. There is a sensibility that has to kick in. And if we're in a position where we're willing to profit on the death and the sex lives of celebrities and, you know.
Or profit on the prophet.
Or profit on the prophet. It's just, yeah, it's just like, come on, guys.
Ask you, though, about, I said I wanted to get into blasphemy with you because it does sort of hit the central notion of what is at stake here. And there was an article, actually it was an op-ed, Mustafa Akaya, who has been on this program, who is a Turkish journalist, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. I don't want to get too into the weeds here theologically, but essentially he argues that the Quran says if someone insults the religion or something, do not sit with them. It doesn't say kill them or behead them or anything of that sort. In fact, it doesn't even talk about earthly punishment. And I realize there's a lot of different interpretations of what the Quran says or what the Quran doesn't say. But he says that there's no screed for blasphemy or for apostasy. It's like, for killing those who are guilty or culpable of this. He said it's almost like tantamount to arguments for female circumcision or stoning somebody to death. They're misappropriations of Islam.
Exactly.
I mean, you both essentially would agree with that. Yeah.
Khalil, you want?
Yeah, I don't even think, as you said, it's a vast domain interpreting any religious texts, let alone the Koran. There's a lot of room for disagreement. That doesn't mean we have to kill one another. To me, the real issue is the background, the context that this falls into. Kabir and Walensky, God rest their souls. I mean, they were dreamers. Everybody agrees about them who knew them, like my friend Slim.
Walensky was a Jew, in fact.
Yes, he was Jewish, yeah. And he helped his Muslim brother, you know, from Algeria. He grew up in Tunisia. You know, there's some affinities. Just as it was, human solidarity and it's most basic and most beautiful. But Slim tells me, and others who knew them tell me, that these two guys, and certainly the other two cartoonists, I'm sure, were dreamers. They were focused on this utopian notion of complete freedom. They were not haters. They're not people who were busy really trying to slight an entire community. And yet, they were detached. They were living in their bubble. And that's what, unfortunately, happened. Reality caught up with them. When you're a child in France, you have these history books that do mention the Holocaust, that atones for for French complicity, official French complicity with that, sending 70,000 Jews to the death camps. They do atone, and they make a big deal about it, as they should. But they don't do the same thing for other victims of the French colonial empire, who were even more affected, in my opinion. Entire genocide happened.
Which prompts me to ask you, we're coming up on a break here, but as someone of Algerian birth, both these brothers were Algerian. And is there, the two brothers were Chechen also in Boston, but is there a sense of colonial history playing its way into
Absolutely.
This?
And when you say they're both Algerian, it's sort of the sum of the French mindset that regardless of the fact they're French and they were born in France, and I don't know what generation, they're second, third, fourth. They're still perceived as
Algerian.
As Algerian.
Which is part of the marginalization that is a concern, certainly, to people of Islamic birth.
Yeah.
We're going to open up the phone lines now and invite those of you listening to join this conversation. In fact, we'd like to hear from you. A lot of topics broached here so far, but certainly the main one is, once again, the freedom to express as opposed to what may or may not be in the minds of jihadis as the need to punish and against that kind of blasphemy that goes with that expression. Our toll-free number, again, is yours. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join the program now with any questions or comments. 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We'll bring you into the conversation when we return. I just wanted to say one other thing about the article that I mentioned, that I referenced, and we'll try to put the link on our website, the op-ed by the Turkish journalist. He also says that in the Quran, Abraham and Jesus are also prophets. And so when one looks at the concern about Muhammad, it does, again, reflect the sense of separation by others or by Islam itself. We'll get into more when we return. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with a couple of local Muslim authors. In fact, cartoonist Khalil Bendi is here with us in studio, and he's a political cartoonist and co-creator of Zahra's Paradise. Also co-hosts a weekly radio program on KPFA called Voices of the Middle East. And Amir Soltani, a human rights activist, author, and co-creator, again, of Zahra's Paradise, which is, by the way, a graphic novel that's set in Iran, which has received a great deal of praise, and which we talked about here on Forum when we were talking about Iranian literature a while back. And let's find out what you, our listeners, have to say. And let me begin with Melenu. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My mother was a Holocaust survivor, so I know the aspect of focusing on people who are different. I believe completely in freedom of speech, and I think it's wrong that the cartoonists kept what I believe is doing harm, and they continue to. What is the outcome? Why do they want to do that? There are many ways to make a point, but I think that they should stop.
Well, I was saying actually to Galil off air that there are many Jews who feel, and it's been both criticized as well as praised and understood, that the Holocaust is almost sacred. You have brought up the Holocaust in your cartoons.
I have, but always in a positive way. I've always defended the victims of the Holocaust and those who want to be protected from foul speech that minimizes in any way the impact.
So when the ADL says you've trivialized the Holocaust, you've compared it to Nazis, these are libels? These are defamations?
These are libels. I should really, I mean, if I had the time and wherewithal to sue them, I should really sue them. They are a defamation league. I once interviewed on my show, since you mentioned it, Voices of the Middle East and North Africa on KPFA, Yoav Shamir, a filmmaker from Israel who made a film titled Defamation. He shadowed Abraham Fox for a few weeks.
Foxman,
yeah. That's right, thank you. And he just filmed everything that was happening. It's a very damning film, and I really recommend it to people who are interested in the ADL to see really what the ADL truly stands for. They're in the business of denigrating and insulting and defaming all who disagree in any fashion with the state of Israel when it does its worst massacres. That's what they're in business for. They're not there to honor the memory of people who have been victims, like the people in the Holocaust.
Let me go to another caller here, and that's you, Frank. Good morning. You're on.
Good morning, Michael. Thanks for the call, letting me in. I'm wondering why the debate has moved to inflaming Muslims when I suggest it should be about the idea that religion can enforce its dictates on believers, but the idea that they can kill people who are not believers who happen to violate those rules seems to me to be absurd. And going a little further, I wonder if it's evidence that big sections of Islam still haven't accepted the idea that the state controls religion in the extent that you have to cooperate, as opposed to you get to run the state by killing the apostate. You know, for example, the Christians did it, 800 years ago, 1,000 years ago, and they finally were either disciplined or changed their minds. I'm wondering why this isn't a discussion now.
Well, there has been talk. Al-Sisi, the head of Egypt, in fact, has talked about the need for a reformation in Islam, and yet one correction, and let me go to you, Amir Sultani, but in terms of what Frank said, there was an Algerian-born copy editor who was killed also by these jihadists, and also a policeman. He was Muslim as well. And, so we're not only talking...
Right. I think once part of the problem is that part of the problem really becomes language at some level, is that the instant you know, Islam, Judaism, these categories are so vast that they take us away from the granularity of something. And that's where you experience the humanity of it the most, you know. Honestly, whether the guard who was killed was Muslim or Jewish, or the cartoonists were Muslim or Jewish, I think all of us, Muslims, Jews, Christians, there are certain things that we don't stand for, or at least I like to think we don't stand for.
But the point is that these are, in the name of Islam, people who are killing their own fellow Muslims. And I was also, I must confess to you, wondering why, with all the Je suis Charlie, there weren't people saying Je suis Jewish, because when you look at the Vichy history and when you look at what happened in that supermarket, these people were killed also because they were Jewish.
The good news is that there were a lot of those signs, actually.
This is the fault of the media again. I never saw one.
Yeah, right. No, actually, there were a lot in those large demonstrations. A lot of people saying, Je suis Juif, Je suis Charlie, Je suis Juif, even those who are not Jewish, standing in solidarity with the victims of the kosher market. I think the listener said something that's not quite accurate. He said, why are we saying that it's okay for those guys to kill? None of us has ever said that. It is not by, you know, that kind of violence is not justified by anything, no matter how invidious the cartoons or the comments or the editorials might have been. It cannot justify even a threat.
Thank you for saying that. Let me get another caller on. It's a caller from Berkeley. Ed, good morning.
Hi, this is Ed Mike. How are you? Good morning. So I like to say, you know, let's ask a question. Who benefit from all of that? These bloody idiots, whether those terrible people in Paris or people in Nigeria or people in Yemen, people wherever, what they have done? Their action was used to cause, including bin Laden. What did bin Laden do? He caused the destruction of a beautiful country of Iraq, as many other countries in the Middle East. He caused the death and the killing of over a million people in the Middle East, Iraq, and everywhere else. Let's ask the question, who benefits from that, and who controls this misled idiot, this stupid idiot? They are not doing anything good for Islam or Muslim. They shame Islam, and they cause a lot of harm to Muslims everywhere in the world. Who benefits from it? The guy in the top, the leader, I don't think he has in his heart anything about Islam or Muslim or anything. They are stupid, uneducated people who do stupid actions. And we have to ask, and ask all of your guests, who benefit from this action? It is, you know, like in Iraq case, it was the new conservative that benefited from Bin Laden action. Iraq still would be a beautiful country until today. Even with terrible Saddam Hussein, he still kept the country together. Who benefited from destroying the Middle East? As I say, the last comment, I'd like to say, I'm very proud of the Egyptian people who kicked out this kind of people out, because Egypt would be just as in bad shape. ISIS shamed the Middle East. We have to ask the question, who benefit? It is not the Muslim. It's not Islam. It's just give dirty water for people like Murdoch and the rest of awful, awful people to use that.
All right, Ed, I thank you for the call. He's asking the question, who benefits from this? I think humanity loses. I don't know if there's any talk about benefits.
We're all becoming losers. But I think there is something that really does need to get addressed, and that there are two separate, for me, questions. One is the question of dissent in the Islamic world. And as someone who's coming from Iran, you see the Islamic Republic of Iran really putting thousands of our best lawyers, our best journalists, most beautiful minds in prison for daring to ask questions, for daring to hold them accountable. So that's one. And literally thousands of Iranians have been killed by the Islamic Republic. So nothing that Salman Rushdie can do to the name of the Prophet begins to compare with what's being done in the name of the Prophet in places like Iran and so on.
Let me go to some emails here. You mentioned, Khalil, intermarriage in France, and David asks, and you may want to clarify this for him. He says, how is intermarriage a good sign? Isn't a non-Muslim spouse required to convert on pain of death?
Well, that's a good question. Precisely, those taboos are falling away within even the Muslim community, which is portrayed as so intolerant. My sister, for example, my sister, her daughter is going to marry a Frenchman who's not Muslim. You know, it used to be that you would ask politely, could you please at least pretend to have converted to Islam so we won't have problems. That's no longer an issue. A lot of people are intermarrying in both directions. The males, the females from the Muslim community are marrying into the larger community. That's a sign of progress for me. So it indicates that things are evolving.
And let me go back to Amir with another email. A listener says, Amir Sultani, it's unarguable that the Charlie Hebdo staff loathe religion of all sorts, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity alike as institutions. However, what do you think about the charge people have made, though in my opinion this misunderstands the cartoons that do feature people of color, that they simply hated people of color? Are charges of racism well-founded, as well as the undisputed fact that they hated religion?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting and powerful question. I mean, in a certain sense, if you look at it, Islam, Muslims, have replaced, in a sense, a lot of the racial attitudes that exist in Europe today, because a lot of Europeans are building their identity as something. What is Europe? What is Europe? What does it stand for? When part of the answer is, what does it stand against? And so that goes into this question of, well, who is and who is not, who is and who is not in. So I think sadly, a lot of the stereotypes that were used for Jews, for African Americans, and so on, it's okay, it's open season to use it on Muslims because of the likes of Bin Laden and so on.
Well, we should mention here, though, that Charlie Hebdo, for example, made fun of and ridiculed the Pope and Hasidic Jews.
Yes,
and, I mean,
but the context was different back then. I grew up following these people's work, and until the 90s, until really the turn of the century, this new century, Charlie Hebdo was really equal up. Skewer, you know, just skewering every religion, every prophet, anything that seemed taboo, they would go for it. What happened, the turning point was 2006 when the Danish cartoons happened, and Charlie Hebdo was not doing well, was about to go bankrupt. The editor at the time, Philippe Val, made this astute move to be the one the one newspaper, the one editor in all of France and all of Europe, other than the Danes, to copy, to print those same cartoons, republish them in his paper. That made him a huge star with the media, which a lot of them are tend to be.
And a huge target for jihadis. I mean,
yeah,
this
exactly,
is the way that Al-Qaeda exactly. once again establishes
then,
itself.
Exactly. So then the focus became, do you have the guts to go against the Muslims, in quotes?
Well, they were taunting them. They were saying,
they were
look, it's coming
them,
up
yes.
on January,
so
and
that
here
completely,
we are.
That completely... completely distorted the entire emphasis that, yes, these guys were iconoclasts and proud to be, but after a while they turned into, and unwittingly turned into these Islamophobes, helping the incite some of the violent fringe inside the Muslim community by doing things that were not necessarily very interesting, very funny, or very respectful.
Actually, I have a caller who's on point. Let me go to that caller. Tim, join us.
Yes, hi. First of all, I'd like to say that if you're a cartoonist and you're not on the Anti-Defamation League's radar, then you're doing something wrong. But, you know, I'm a big freedom of expression person. I was really disappointed when NPR, PBS, and the New York Times decided not to reproduce the cartoons. But I was a little bit put out when the American Jewish Committee kind of came out with the same statement saying that they're trying to, that it allows them to create an atmosphere of fear where freedom of expression is limited and make Islam alone among all other world religions and secular ideologies immune from public criticism. When in 2009, because of LICRA, which is essentially the French Anti-Defamation League, they pushed to get Ciné, a cartoonist at Charlie Hebdo, fired because of some supposedly anti-Semitic comments he made about Sarkozy's son. And when Ciné refused to apologize for it, he said, je préfère me couper les couilles, I'd rather cut my balls off, they fired him. So it just kind of, I'm curious what you guys have to say about that and about the double standard sometimes that is in effect here.
I think that's thank you for that.
Khalil Bendib.
Yeah, this is Khalil Bendib, the cartoonist. Thank you for that intervention because it's at the center, in my opinion, of what the problem is. The double standard really rankles. A lot of respect for some and zero, humiliation really for others.
But you could make the counter argument that there's a double standard by trying to, protect those who feel that Islam is being vilified or defamed or anything along those
right.
lines.
Right. So on the one hand, it is considered freedom of the press when it's attached to the Muslims. Anything goes, this is beautiful freedom of the press. And it's considered hate speech when it comes to the Jews. You can't do that anymore to the Jews. So that's at the center of the problem. I agree with you.
But I think there's just to...
Amir Sultan.
I think there's, at the risk of... at the risk of being too much of a devil's advocate, I think there are serious questions here also about the freedom of expression. And again, if we look, take for example, the case of Nicole Brown, the O.J. Simpson case. I was watching that and I'm not saying this as a Muslim or a Jew, just watching it. And you would hear jokes being cracked. You'd go to the supermarket and there were images of bloody shirts and knives and things being thrown on food. And, so there was this feeding frenzy and human blood was being used to stimulate it. And I kept on thinking, my God, what happened? What is happening to O.J. Simpson's kids? Everyone is exercising their freedom of expression. But this expression will traumatize and damage these kids for years to come. So I think that, and then it goes to, metaphors, whether it's cockroaches, rats, insects, all these things that are used for Jews or Muslims or African Americans. Once the animal comparisons come in, if you are not super alert to hatred as it creeps through language, as it creeps through cartoons, whether it's against Jews or Muslims, you're going to be in trouble. So, the freedom of expression, great, but we've got to be very alert to the ways in which venom gets transmitted through language.
It's difficult. It's a difficult issue because
it's a good wise statement. I'm sorry, you're going to say.
Yeah, it's a case by case. There's no simple solution.
Well, in fact, when you're talking about case by case, I can't help thinking. In fact, when Amir was talking about the fact that there are now there was a news story that was reported on NPR this morning about a Jordanian cartoonist who is doing superheroes fighting jihadis. Now this may help the Hashemite kingdom, admittedly, may be in their best interest, but there is a whole other side of this. We had on the forum program, we had Bassem Youssef of Egypt, who's called, you know, the John Stewart of Egypt and so forth, but who does satire and kind of lampooning of figures that's done in what anybody would recognize as a more positive way. Ali Sattaf, is that how he pronounces his name? The Syrian who had his hands broken.
Right. Yes, yes.
Yeah. And in Lebanon and Iraq, they're ridiculing ISIS and al-Baghdadi. I mean, you know, right. There are different things that are happening that we are not as aware of as we
exactly.
need to be.
Because our media tend to focus on the lurid and the morbid. Because it's more exciting, it's more sensational. But the positive things, that you just mentioned.
But we have much freer expression here. I mean, there are jokes made about the Kennedy assassination, even jokes about 9/11.
But you know, it's very interesting this thing about superheroes. Because as an Iranian and a Muslim, I actually have my superheroes. His name is Rumi and Hafez and, you know, Ferdowsi. I mean, we have our superheroes. I mean, look at Hafez.
I'm not Iranian. Rumi's one of my heroes.
Of course. I mean, and you know, love is at the center. You know, it's funny how it's gotten lost, but love is also at the center of so much that defines Persian culture, Islamic culture, and that's lost. I mean, Hafez, I was writing this poem of Hafez, which is plant the tree, plant the seeds of joy, for they bring boundless boundless life, and uproot the saplings of enmity, for they bring countless sorrow. This is Hafez. This is 600 years ago, and it's part of the DNA of the Islamic world and of Iran. It's just that when we're focusing on al-Baghdadi and whatever, we lose the giants. I mean, the midgets are coming and blocking the giants. I mean,
well, they're not midgets though, because they're shedding an enormous amount of carnage and blood.
Well,
and
that's of course, why they but I mean, spiritually,
and they want the attention. Because,
yes, but
let me bring some more of our callers on. Jack, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. The French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo has a long reputation of offending people of all religions, which has stirred much outrage. Except amongst Muslims. While no religious groups are immune to violence, there is clearly a greater propensity of violent outrage from Islamic extremists. And to murder innocent people shouting God is great is surely an affront to Islam and the Creator whom they claim to worship. However, before we in the West drench ourselves in a false sense of virtue, we need to view past events to better understand how we in the Western world might have stirred the collective outrage in Muslim countries. The Islamic terrorists who have been wreaking so much havoc for the last quarter of a century were bred much the same way as killer bees. A few examples. In 1953, the CIA orchestrated a coup in Iran and overthrew the democratically elected government Mossadegh. We then trained, armed, and organized young militant Muslims to repel the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And when we left them twisting in the wind, they turned against us. We then aided and abetted Israel in cleansing Palestinians from their ancestral land. And following the 9/11 attack, the Bush-Cheney cabal ordered prisoners to be tortured and falsely confess that Saddam Hussein was responsible for 9/11 attack. And the shock and awe of Iraq resulted in hundreds of thousands of Iraqi deaths. We then followed bin Laden to the caves of Afghanistan, unleashing U.S. firepower, which fueled intense anger and resentment in Afghanistan and neighboring Pakistan.
Hi, Jack. I thank you for that historical synopsis and update, and I want to get another caller on. Vince, that's you. Hi.
Hi, I'm calling about the double standard that was mentioned earlier. And, you know, it seems like there's a lot of taxing going on about ADL, and I don't think that's right, because the ADL or other organizations, they use legal and civilized methods to, you know, get people fired or go through the court system. And they're subject to it, court cases and lawsuits. These Muslims are killing people for attacking, for being critical of Islam. They're killing people. They're blowing up embassies. They're doing all kinds of hateful activities that are not within the civilized framework of justice that we have in this country and in the West. And that's absolutely wrong. And I think attacking these other institutions is just taking our focus off the freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And please don't justify somebody's killing by saying that it's extreme what Charlie Hebdo or what other organizations or Rupert Murdoch are doing. That's their business. The Islam told you to be patient, and Islam told you to pray, and from that the results will come.
Let me ask a little bit. I don't think you were comparing the ADL to these jihadists who slaughtered people
in the
kosher supermarket or, for that matter, in Charlie Hebdo.
No, I was not, although they do use some illegal means, certainly.
They do use the courts, too. The caller is right. I mean, they have.
Yeah, but they mostly do their work in the shadows. They don't just come up to somebody and try to have a debate with them. They just go and trash them and try to smear them. So I'm not crazy about the ADL.
I understand that, but they've always been this is a dualistic type of thing. They've always done a lot of work on behalf of civil rights. And when they say non-defamation, they mean defamation. I mean, they've actually brought suits against the Ku Klux Klan and other organizations of that sort.
Right.
So,
but I would like to address some of the claims by your listener. There is a perception, fortunately, here that Muslims somehow are especially innately whatever violent. There's a lot of violence right now in Muslim countries. It's very sad. It's terrifying. But to somehow single out the faith of Islam associated with mayhem is a little bit distorted, because when you look at what this country, our country, which we all love, has done in Iraq, I'm sorry, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of victims. What Israel has done repeatedly in Palestine, also we're talking about large numbers of people.
We are not talking about morality of a high nature when we talk about virtually any of these countries that have been mentioned here. However, here's one thing that has come up on forum before, and I'd like your response to it, and that is in countries like Egypt, for example, there have been some pretty consistent polls that show that high percentages of people go along with Sharia law, and high percentages of people say that if someone blasphemes the prophet, for example, they should die. Now, these are not necessarily people who would want to execute or kill somebody, but nevertheless, they go along with that idea. And so how do you separate that from the jihadists who do actually carry out those things?
Personally, I take those polls with a grain of salt, having my experience as somebody who lived there in North Africa until age 20 and then goes back on a regular basis. It's not my experience that people are saying, oh, yeah, let's kill so-and-so for leaving the religion or for saying the wrong thing. That is not my personal experience. I don't know, Amir, what you think. But that's not the people I know around me in Algeria and Egypt. These polls, I don't know how they're conducted, if they're really being scientifically conducted, if they ask the right questions. They don't seem to reflect my experience and the people I know who are Muslim.
Let me read some online comments.
Michael,
and
can
emails.
I,
yeah, Amir,
just
go
a
ahead.
Very so. Quick thing. There was a recent poll by, I think it was Pew, that a significant majority of Republicans are saying that torture in certain instances is okay. But most Americans that you come across don't seem to be, you know, embracing torture. So I think that, the questions are wrong. I almost feel that the questions are wrong. The framing is wrong. It's like, really, Americans aren't, you know, in the Islamic world now, a lot of Americans are seen as supportive of torture in the same way that in America, a lot of Muslims are seen as supportive of terrorism. But it's just, we're just absolutely crossing, you know, we're not meeting each other. The conversations that need to happen, which are happening when Khalid is talking about intermarriage or, you know, these daily interactions. There are a million Iranians in America. They're having they're working. They're having a great life. There's the connections between us are so much stronger than what people are. And frankly, even between Iran and Israel. I mean, there was a whole campaign in Israel about Israel loves Iran to stop the potential bombing of Iran. So, I mean, we are not seeing the good side of things. And I think that's really problematic.
There's a caller and a number of emailers who are saying Muslims need to speak out more. What do you both say about that? Moderate Muslims, reasonable Muslims, humanistic Muslims like yourselves that
we
don't hear enough from you.
Khalil and I have published Zahra's Paradise. We don't have, if Mr. Murdoch were to give us his media, we would do a lot more. But we have to, we have limited means and we do what we can with what we have.
Yeah, and there's always an assumption that our media, which is where we get our information in this country, in most countries, are a clear glass that you can see right through it and there's no distortion, no bias. Unfortunately, that is not the case. We get distorted perceptions of what's out there. They're violent. They don't. They're strange. They're different than us. That is not really the full truth.
Amir Sultani, Khalil Bendib, thank you both for being with us.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
We appreciate your time, and we appreciate your listenership. As I'm speaking now to our listeners, we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can, of course, continue this discussion online. Go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our new interns start this week, Megan Sussman and Nunu Teo, and we'd like to say a special thank you to departing interns, the talented and hardworking Riley Ryan and Natalie Yemenijan. They have made wonderful contributions to this show, and we will miss them and wish them the best. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.